Imagine just walking into a regular grocery store and suddenly you feel this sharp physical pain right behind your eyes from those bright fluorescent lights overhead.
Oh, yeah, those lights can be intense.
Right, and at the exact same time, you hear the squeak of a shopping cart wheel like three aisles over, but to your brain, it registers as a blaring fire alarm.
It's completely overwhelming.
It is, and even the smell of the bakery, it doesn't just smell like bread. It literally feels like a physical weight pressing down on your chest.
Yeah, that sensory input just piles up so fast.
Exactly. And for millions of autistic children and teens, this isn't, an exaggeration. It's not a metaphor. It is their actual biological reality.
It really is. I mean, it's a completely different physiological experience of the world.
Yeah.
Because for most of us, the brain has this, well, it has an automatic filter, right?
Right, like we just tune things out.
Exactly. We
Yeah.
subconsciously categorize things. The hum of a refrigerator or, the overlapping chatter in a busy food court that just becomes background noise.
We don't even notice it.
We really don't. But when that filter doesn't operate the same way, the mundane environment becomes an absolute full-blown crisis.
So today we are taking a deep dive into a topic that profoundly affects so many families, but honestly, it is consistently misunderstood by the general public.
Oh, completely misunderstood.
Yeah, we are unpacking how public spaces impact autistic children and teens, specifically looking at sensory overload. And to do this, we're pulling from a comprehensive new guide published literally today, June 9, 2026, by AngelSense.
Right, and they're a company that specializes in assistive GPS technology for special needs families, which we'll definitely get into later.
We will, and we want to welcome you to the conversation today because you need to hear this. This is such a crucial
It
topic.
really is vital because public spaces, I mean, whether that's the park, the airport, or just a local restaurant, they aren't just places to run errands.
No, they're like training grounds, right?
Precisely. They are where a child builds their independence, their confidence, and just everyday life skills. But these environments are also incredibly unpredictable.
Unpredictable is the perfect word for it.
And that unpredictability triggers intense, often very visible responses.
Okay, let's unpack this right out of the gate because the source guide demands a complete paradigm shift from how society usually views these
A
moments.
huge shift.
Like if you are at the mall and you see an autistic child reacting strongly, maybe they're crying uncontrollably, or they're completely frozen in an aisle, or even physically lashing out.
People tend to judge that so harshly.
They really do. But you are not watching bad behavior. You're not watching some defiant kid who just needs stricter discipline.
No, not at all.
You are witnessing a genuine, involuntary nervous system response. The child feels fundamentally unsafe.
Exactly. Their brain is quite literally sounding an alarm.
Yeah.
It's treating the environment as a literal physical threat.
Wow.
So during this deep dive, we are going to explore the hidden triggers embedded within these everyday spaces, and look at how caregivers can proactively conserve a child's sensory energy.
And crucially, how to safely navigate those intense moments when the environment simply becomes way too much.
Right. So to really grasp how to prepare for an outing, we have to look under the hood first. We have to understand why a simple trip to the mall operates as this complex sensory minefield.
Because we hear the phrase sensory processing disorder tossed around all the time, right?
Constantly. SPD is a huge buzzword.
But biologically, like on the ground, what is actually happening?
Well, what's happening is basically a massive neurological traffic jam. Sensory processing disorder often affects all of the senses simultaneously.
All of them at once.
Yes, all at once. It's a misfiring in how the nervous system receives messages from the senses and turns them into appropriate responses. Let's just look at the five senses based on what the guide highlights.
Okay, let's do it.
Take sight, for instance. The bright artificial lights of a mall or an airport can be visually overstimulating. But what's fascinating here is that the guide notes this is often drastically worse at night.
Wait, really? Why a night? I would assume that's because of the contrast, like the dark parking lot versus the glaring indoor lighting.
That is exactly it. The human eye has to adjust, and the stark immediate contrast between the dark outside and the sudden glaring fluorescent lights inside it delivers a massive jolt to an already sensitive visual system.
Man, that sounds painful.
It is. And then you compound that with sound. It's not just the sheer volume of a crowd that hurts, it's the overlapping chaotic frequencies.
Right, like a PA system announcing
Yeah,
something.
the sudden burst of a PA announcement, The low rumble of traffic outside, overhead aircraft, and, you know, the high-pitched, unpredictable noises of other kids playing.
So they can't tune it out?
No, the brain can't isolate just one sound. It hears them all at equal, deafening volume.
And I imagine smell and touch are just as intrusive, right? Like walking through a mall, you have the food court odors clashing with some perfume counter, clashing with the smell of floor cleaner.
Oh, the smells are incredibly overwhelming.
And the guide actually points out that touch is a massive trigger to specifically unwanted, unexpected physical contact from total strangers.
Yeah, even just a harmless brush against a shoulder in a crowded aisle can trigger a major threat response.
That sounds like an absolute assault on the nervous system.
It really is. But there is a secondary layer to this that's largely psychological, the loss of control.
Oh, sure.
Public spaces inherently disrupt an autistic person's routine. Think about it. There are unclear, unwritten social rules.
Like where to stand or who goes first.
Exactly. There's waiting in lines, which feels endless and agonizing when your body is already overwhelmed. There are unpredictable transitions.
Transitions are so tough.
Like walking from a quiet shop into a massive echoing concourse. All of this strips away the child's feeling of predictability and safety.
It's like imagine your brain is a computer, right? And suddenly someone opens 50 browser tabs at once.
Yes. Perfect analogy.
And they're all playing different audio tracks at maximum volume while someone else keeps, I don't know, unplugging and plugging in your mouse.
Right. The processor is just going to freeze up entirely.
Totally. Because the brain has a finite amount of processing power. So every single hour you're awake drains that battery.
It drains it fast.
So if we know that battery is going to be severely tested at the mall, how do we conserve it before we even leave the driveway? Like, why does a child handle the grocery store perfectly on a Tuesday morning, but experience a severe response to the exact same store on a Thursday afternoon?
Well, it really comes down to their baseline stress level. If a child is already tired after a long, socially and academically demanding day at school,
their sensory battery is basically running on empty.
Exactly. Their threshold for what they can tolerate is vastly lower than if they tackled that exact same environment first thing in the morning on a weekend.
Okay, so knowing that the battery is draining, the guide emphasizes what we can call the art of the pregame.
Yes, pregaming is essential.
The caregiver has to know the early warning signs of a drained battery, right?
They absolutely do. It's an escalation ladder. Sensory overload very rarely comes out of nowhere. The nervous system actually sends out warning flares.
Like what kind of flares?
First, the child might demonstrate subtle discomfort. They might become unusually quiet, slightly irritable, or start repeatedly asking when they can leave.
Got it. The early yellow flags.
Right. And if those yellow flags are missed or just ignored by the adults, the latter escalates quickly.
How so?
The child might start physically blocking the input, like covering their ears or their eyes. They might freeze in place, start pacing anxiously, or begin to cry.
So the nervous system is visibly ramping up its defense mechanisms at that point.
Exactly. It's trying to protect itself.
Okay, I want to push back on this for just a second because I know there's a really specific mindset out there.
Okay, I know what you mean.
Yeah, like as a parent, sometimes your instinct is to just, you know, rip the Band-Aid off. If a kid struggles with the grocery store, shouldn't you just take them to the grocery store every single day until they build up a tolerance?
The forced exposure approach.
Yeah. Doesn't natural exposure force them to get used to the real world?
It is a very common instinct, but the source material pushes back on that idea incredibly firmly. The goal is never to force, quote unquote, tolerance of overwhelming environments.
Never.
Never. It is about safe participation. A neurodivergent nervous system does not simply adapt to sensory pain through forced exposure.
So it doesn't get easier just by doing it more?
No. In fact, forcing them through it usually just leads to severe anxiety and long-term trauma. No one should ever tell an autistic individual to just be patient or push through what their brain is registering as actual physical pain.
Okay. So it's fundamentally about accommodation, not assimilation. We aren't trying to change their brain. We're trying to change the environment to make it survivable.
That is perfectly said, yes.
So practically speaking, for you listening right now, what does that strategic planning look like?
Well, it involves minimizing the environmental impact before you even arrive. The guide recommends arriving at public spaces before peak crowd levels.
Which makes perfect sense. I mean, shorter lines, fewer overlapping voices, drastically fewer chances of being bumped into by strangers.
Exactly. And if you go early, you can park closer to the entrance, which is vital if you end up needing to make a quick getaway.
Oh, that's smart.
The source also highly recommends downloading maps of the location beforehand to identify quiet areas and bathroom locations.
So you aren't wandering around lost.
Right. They also emphasize creating a clear visual plan for the child, like a simple flow chart or a schedule with pictures. That way they know exactly what to expect.
Because predictability is the absolute antidote to anxiety.
It really is.
And then you have the physical prep, the sensory safety kit.
The kit is a lifesaver.
Right. Because if you see a teenager wearing dark sunglasses and heavy ear defenders in a grocery store, your first instinct might be that they're trying to look cool or ignore their parents.
Which is such a common misconception.
Totally. But what you're actually looking at is a carefully constructed survival kit. Caregivers pack noise-canceling headphones, sunglasses to dim the fluorescent lights, and fidget tools or chewables that provide soothing proprioceptive feedback to really ground the nervous system.
It's all about giving them the tools to filter the environment themselves.
And here is a brilliant tip from the guide that feels so simple but is so effective. Bring familiar drinks and snacks from home.
Yes, such a good tip.
Because you bypass the unpredictability of a restaurant line, you avoid the clashing smells of a food court, and you guarantee the child has a flavor and texture they feel entirely safe with.
You're basically creating a portable bubble of familiarity for them.
I love that phrase, portable bubble.
But despite the best laid plans, we have to address what happens when that bubble pops. Like, what happens when the sensory input overwhelms all those preparations and the child's ability to communicate begins to fracture?
Okay, yeah. I found this detail in the text completely fascinating. The guide points out that even children or teens who have perfectly decent verbal skills, like kids who can usually articulate exactly what they want.
Right, highly verbal kids.
Yeah, they can completely lose the ability to speak during sensory overload.
Yes, they absolutely can.
I really want to understand the mechanics here. Why does someone who is perfectly articulate suddenly lose their speech just because a fire engine went by or a crowd got too dense?
It all has to do with how the brain prioritizes its resources during a perceived threat. Think of the prefrontal cortex as the CEO of the brain. It handles logic, reasoning, and language.
Okay, the CEO.
Right. But deep inside the brain is the amygdala, which basically acts as the fire alarm. When sensory overload hits, the amygdala detects a life-threatening crisis.
So the fire alarm goes off?
Exactly. It completely hijacks the system and shuts down the prefrontal cortex to redirect all energy toward basic survival. In that moment, forming words and processing language is a luxury the brain simply cannot afford. The speech centers physically go offline.
That is wild. So it's not a stubborn refusal to speak. It's a temporary biological inability.
Exactly. It is involuntary.
Which means relying on verbal communication in a crisis is a complete setup for failure.
100%.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The guide provides a whole backup system for when words fail. You have to rely on alternative communication supports, things like AAC devices.
Yes, augmentative and alternative communication.
For those of you unfamiliar, AAC devices can be as simple as a tablet app filled with picture buttons. The child taps a picture of a house and the device speaks the word home out loud.
It's amazing technology.
Or you can use physical visual communication cards kept on a lanyard, or even just pre-agreed upon hand gestures.
The guide also points out how vital texting can be for older kids and teens.
Oh, texting is huge.
Because a teenager might feel deeply self-conscious pulling out visual cards in the middle of a crowded mall, but they can very discreetly type out a quick text message to a parent standing right next to them.
That makes so much sense. And the key is having simple foundational phrases already loaded up or practiced. Things like too loud or I need a break or just go home.
Keep it simple.
Right. You aren't asking them to articulate the complex nuances of their anxiety. You just need the core instruction.
And when you receive that core instruction, the exit strategy must be executed immediately. The source is adamant about this.
Immediately. No lingering.
Scheduling a supervised break in a quiet corner, returning to the car, or finding a sensory room isn't optional. It is mandatory.
The adults in the group have to agree on a hard stop time before they even leave the house.
Yes, and they must be willing to abandon the shopping trip immediately if the child starts to lose regulation.
Which brings up a very practical, almost funny observation from the text that I think every parent can relate to. You need to print a map of the mall yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we all know those giant "you are here" display directors are notoriously impossible to find when you're in a total panic and your kid is on the verge of a breakdown.
It seems like a minor detail, but when the amygdala is hijacked, the caregivers are often panicking too. Knowing exactly which corridor leads to the closest exit without having to wander around searching for a sign can prevent a difficult moment from escalating into a dangerous one.
But let's look at the reality of the worst-case scenario. Despite the sensory kit, the printed maps, the visual schedules, sometimes the sensory input simply boils over.
It happens.
So how do we distinguish between the two major types of overload responses? And more importantly, how do we handle the severe safety risks they create?
Well, the guide draws a very necessary distinction between an autistic shutdown and an autistic meltdown.
Okay, break this down for us.
They are fundamentally different outward responses to the exact same internal problem, which is overwhelming input. To use an analogy, a shutdown is like a circuit breaker tripping to prevent an electrical fire.
So the system just powers down.
Yes, to protect itself. It is a state of profound introversion and exhaustion. The individual might refuse to move, completely stop speaking, show zero response to their name, and just stare blankly straight ahead.
So the shutdown is the circuit breaker tripping. That makes a meltdown the equivalent of like a boiling pot of water overflowing on the stove.
Exactly. An autistic meltdown is an explosion of energy. It involves intense physical and verbal expression because the body's fight or flight system is in complete overdrive.
It just has nowhere else to put that sensory energy.
Right. And the guide emphasizes a critical distinction here for the public to understand. While a meltdown might look somewhat similar to a toddler's temper tantrum to an untrained eye, they are entirely different mechanisms.
Right, because a tantrum is goal-directed. A child wants a candy bar, you say no, they throw a fit to manipulate the outcome.
Correct. If you hand them the candy bar, the tantrum stops. A meltdown is a complete, terrifying loss of behavioral control. They aren't trying to manipulate you. They are literally drowning in sensory input. Handing them a toy won't stop it because the environment is still attacking their senses.
I want to pause on the recommended response to a meltdown, specifically the fewer words rule, because as a parent or caregiver, your very first instinct when a child is in distress is to comfort them with your voice.
Of course it is.
You want to get down on their level, reason with them, and ask them, honey, what's wrong? Tell me how to fix it. Why is comforting them actually making the situation worse?
It is entirely counterintuitive for most loving caregivers. But you have to remember that auditory input is a massive part of the sensory overload that caused the meltdown in the first place.
Oh, wow.
When you talk to them, when you ask them questions that require them to process language and formulate an answer, you are actively adding more sensory and cognitive input to a brain that is already overflowing.
By trying to help, your voice is actually pouring more water into the overflowing pot.
Yes. The source strictly advises against trying to reason during a meltdown. Use fewer words. Stop talking.
So what do you do instead?
Your entire focus needs to shift away from logic and entirely to the physical environment. Move them to a safe, quiet location. Protect them from physical harm, protect them from the crowds, and honestly, protect them from the judgment of onlookers.
And once you get to that quiet spot,
you wait in silence. Focus on physical safety and nervous system regulation, and you do not continue the errand. The trip is officially over.
Which is hard to accept if you haven't finished the grocery shopping, but it's biologically necessary. And there's another response to this overload that introduces a severe safety threat. The text highlights a staggering statistic. 50% of autistic kids wander.
It's a huge number.
Half of them. And in a massive public space, even a momentary distraction, like a caregiver turning their back for literally 5 seconds to hand a cashier a credit card, that can result in a child taking off.
It's a terrifying reality for families. It is the literal flight aspect of the fight or flight response.
So they aren't just exploring.
No, the child isn't just wandering off to look at something. Their brain is screaming at them to escape the painful environment at any cost.
So how do caregivers mitigate that risk? The guide suggests a mix of non-tech and tech interventions. For non-tech, they suggest using a buddy system for busy outings,
where one adult is solely responsible for having eyes on the child at all times.
Right. Or setting strict, explicit visual boundaries, like physically showing a child they cannot go past the red fencing of the playground.
Visual boundaries are great.
But the guide highlights GPS trackers as the ultimate necessary backup, specifically pointing to the technology built by AngelSense.
And if we look at how technology has evolved, GPS systems have fundamentally changed how families can safely navigate public spaces.
It's not just an AirTag, right?
No, the guide details that the AngelSense system isn't just an AirTag or a basic location dot on a smartphone map. It is a comprehensive wearable device designed explicitly for the unique crises of neurodivergent wandering.
One of the features that really stood out is geofencing. For anyone unfamiliar, geofencing is basically drawing an invisible digital boundary on a map, like a circle around a specific playground or a school.
Right.
If the child wearing the device crosses that invisible line, the caregiver gets an immediate blaring alert on their phone.
It drastically cuts down the reaction time. And crucially, the device features remote alarms and a two-way speaker system.
Oh, that's incredible.
It is. So if a child bolts in a crowded, echoing mall and you lose sight of them, you can activate a loud alarm on their wearable device to physically locate them in the crowd.
Just follow the sound.
Exactly. Or you can use the two-way speaker to talk to them directly. If they are hiding somewhere because they are overwhelmed, you can use a calm voice to soothe them while you navigate toward their exact GPS coordinates.
Wow.
The system even allows parents to share real-time tracking data instantly with first responders if a search becomes necessary.
It provides just an incredible layer of peace of mind. But eventually, the crisis is managed, the child is located, the meltdown subsides, the environment is escaped, and you make it safely back home.
You survive the trip.
Right. But the text makes it clear that the experience isn't over just because you walk through the front door.
No, it's really not.
The way families handle the aftermath dictates whether the next outing will be a success or a failure.
The recovery phase is just as critical as the pregame prep.
The immediate home protocol the guide outlines is incredibly grounding. You immediately get them to a dark, quiet area. You check their basic physical needs. Are they hungry? Are they thirsty?
Address the basics first.
And then you just allow them to engage in their preferred quiet time activities. No demands, no lectures about what happened, just silence and recovery.
Because a meltdown or a shutdown takes a massive physical toll on the human body. They're going to be exhausted. Their cortisol levels have been spiking. Their heart rate has been elevated. They need biological rest.
So what does this all mean? Once the dust has settled, how do we move forward? How does a family turn a disastrous mall trip, one that ended in an emergency exit and exhaustion, into a building block for the future?
Well, you do it through objective reflection, but only once everyone, and I mean including the caregivers, is completely calm.
Right. You can't do it while you're still stressed.
Caregivers need to review the event objectively. Was there a flaw in our pre-game plan? Did we stay an hour too long? Did we miss the subtle yellow flags of the escalation ladder?
You have to be honest with yourself.
And importantly, you ask the child to rate their stress level. If they communicate that the event was a total disaster, caregivers have to accept that.
Yeah.
Maybe that specific environment or that specific duration simply isn't developmentally appropriate for them right now.
So you scale it back. You don't force it.
Exactly. Building long-term coping skills isn't about forcing big traumatic leaps. It's about managed micro steps. What's fascinating here is how the guide frames practicing these skills.
Right, like practicing asking for a break at home on a random Tuesday, long before you ever leave the house.
Practice when there's no pressure.
Or having the child get used to wearing their noise-canceling headphones while watching TV in the living room. That way, the physical sensation of the headphones is familiar, and they don't feel self-conscious putting them on when they actually need them in the grocery store.
You're exposing them to the tool, not forcing exposure to the stressor.
Yes, exposing to the tool.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is entirely about giving the child real, actionable tools to communicate their bodily needs. It's about choosing quieter, off-peak times of day to set them up for success.
It's setting them up to win.
Every single successfully managed micro-outing protects their dignity, builds their confidence in their own coping mechanisms, and slowly, safely increases their independence in the world.
It is a profound journey for a family. So, to recap the landscape we've explored with you all today, navigating public spaces requires a fundamental shift in understanding. We have to recognize that these environments are profound, painful sensory triggers, not just background noise.
Absolutely.
It requires proactively packing a sensory toolkit, establishing nonverbal communication systems before the prefrontal cortex goes offline, understanding the deep neurological differences between shutdowns and meltdowns, and utilizing advanced tools like Angel Sense to prevent the very real danger of wandering.
It's a lot of work, but it's essential.
And finally, it's about reflecting safely at home to build the micro steps for tomorrow. These aren't just parenting tips. These are essential strategies that make the physical world more accessible for neurodivergent individuals.
It is ultimately about changing our approach to the environment, rather than demanding that individuals change their neurology to fit in.
Beautifully said.
And this raises an important question, something we haven't really touched on yet, but is vital to leave you all to think about.
Oh, let's hear it.
We spend so much time talking about how families must adapt to public spaces, how caregivers are the ones who need to buy the noise-canceling headphones, memorize the exit maps, and carry the heavy burden of making the world manageable.
It's all on their shoulders.
But considering that these sensory triggers are purely environmental, the blinding bright lights, the echoing chaotic architecture, the complete lack of designated quiet zones in commercial spaces, how much of this overload could be entirely eliminated if urban planners, architects, and business owners began treating sensory accessibility as just as fundamental to a building's design as wheelchair ramps?
Wow, that completely flips the responsibility back onto us as a society, exactly where it belongs.
It really does.
It's a powerful thought to leave on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, keep seeking out new perspectives, and we will catch you next time.